Hi, I'm Ricky Gervais.
My name's Steve Merchant.
I'm Carl Pilkington. Right.
And you're listening to the World's Technology Podcast.
The World's Technology Podcast is brought to you in part by the Medtronic Foundation, committed to changing the way the world treats chronic disease. Learn more at Medtronic.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
Hey, everybody, from the world's Brussels Bureau, in other words, my house, it's Clark, and this is Tech Podcast 287, getting a little help there at the top from George Jetson. No better way to start a tech podcast off than with George Jetson. Now, why? Well, you're going to have to stick around to the end of the podcast to find out. Sorry about that, but I got to give you a reason for sticking around, and you never know. We might even sprinkle a few select Jetson sound bites in throughout the podcast. Anyway, the World's Tech Podcast is, of course, your source for undercovered technology stories. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can find out about all of our great podcasts at theworld.org/podcasts. Oh, and here's a little reminder before we kick things off.
Have an iPad, an iPhone, or an iPod Touch? You can now access this podcast on demand wherever you are, anytime through the PRI app. Listen to recent episodes or catch The World and other PRI programs live each day while on the go. Search under PRI in the iTunes App Store or simply click the link at theworld.org.
Okay, let's jump right in here. Let's talk about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, I'll admit that this story is not undercovered. However, I promise a unique take on it. Now, 210,000 gallons of oil a day are still being pumped into the Gulf after last month's oil rig explosion. Oil executives are due to appear on Capitol Hill today to answer questions about the disaster. Now, meanwhile, the oil company responsible for the rig, British Petroleum, or BP, is going to try to make another attempt to cap the blown-out well that's leaking. Now, they tried to place a huge dome over it this past weekend. Those efforts failed when gas hydrates, ice like crystals lighter than water, built up inside the 100-ton metal container. That could have made the dome buoyant, which would prevent it from being effective in capping the flow of the oil. Currently, the company is trying to thin the leaking oil by spraying it with chemical dispersants. They're also considering sealing the well with debris. But BP's chief operating officer, Doug Suttles, said the company would now try to place a smaller dome-like structure known as a top hat over the well.
It's approximately 4 feet in diameter. It's about 5 feet tall. Weighs just less than 2 tons. The difference in this and the previous dome is this dome is actually built such that we can hopefully exclude much of the water that causes the difficulty with the hydrates. In addition to that, we'll be able to inject methanol and circulate hot water. We think these two additions, along with the smaller size, should provide an opportunity to deal with the problems we encountered with the first dome.
Well, the BBC has been talking to a lot of oil experts about this. One of them is Mike Miller with Safety Boss, a Canadian blowout company. He made his name tackling oil fires in Kuwait in the aftermath of the Gulf War in 1991. He told the BBC that the Gulf of Mexico blowout is extraordinarily difficult to tackle because it happened offshore.
You know, had this been on land, it'd be much more simple. It'd probably be over by now. But you're just very limited as to what you can do in 5,000 feet of water. I was never very confident that the box or the dome situation would work. There was just a lot of complications in making that work. And again, you know, you have to bear in mind it's almost freezing at the bottom of the ocean. I think it's 2-3 degrees centigrade. And gas does form hydrates, which are like iceberg plugs there. The only sure shot they have is the relief well, which is about a week underway. But unfortunately, it's got almost 7 weeks to go. It's 3 weeks or 3 months to complete it. And, of course, they're trying anything else they can.
Meanwhile, citizens on the coast are preparing for the worst as well as the oil comes ashore. Some are using a citizen reporting tool we featured many times here on this show, Ushahidi, to collate reports and information about the spill and its effects. Others are devising a unique strategy for mopping up the oil that comes ashore. Here's an interview from the BBC.
Well, among all the frantic efforts to try to contain the spill, there is one project that's a little more unusual than most. It involves a combination of, yes, human hair, animal hair, and used or defective tights. That's tights as in the things that go on your legs, usually women's legs. Seriously, volunteers along the Gulf Coast will be gathering over the next few days to lay down booms made of these natural sources to try to literally mop up the oil. So how does it work? Well, with us to give us more details is Lisa Gauthier. She's president of the San Francisco-based charity Matter of Trust, coordinating the efforts, as well as one of those volunteers, Amanda Bacon, who's in Mobile, Alabama. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Lisa, I think some of our listeners are going to find this a little bit far-fetched. So tell us, how does it work?
Well, basically, they'll all understand it if you say you shampoo because hair collects oil. Really what's happening is your hair is doing work. Each hair follicle is being coated in your skin oils, or it's taking air out of the, it's taking oil out of the pollution in the air. And as it gathers up, your hair gets stickier and stickier, and then every once in a while you have to shampoo. And as it turns out in the U.S., there are about 370,000 hair salons, and there's about another 100,000, groomers. The salons cut about a pound of hair a day, and the groomers cut about 3 pounds of fur a day. And now we're getting alpaca farmers and sheep farmers coming into the picture with all of their waste wool, and we just have thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds being signed up to our website every day, and they all want it to ship it at their own expense, very generous, to the Gulf Coast and to people like Amanda.
Okay, before we hear from Amanda, who's going to have the job of using hair to soak up all the oil, what did you do? Was it an internet-based appeal that you put the message out to all these hair salons across the United States saying send us your hair?
Well, 20 years ago for the Exxon Valdez, a hairstylist named Phil McCrory was watching the otters coated in oil while he was shampooing a very oily head of hair, and it just sort of clicked for him that this would work. And about a dozen years ago, we met up with him, our charity, and we love to work with surplus and find uses for surplus. And for all of these years, we've been gathering a database of salons that like to send us hair clippings, and we make these booms. And about 8 days ago, when the spill started to happen, we started to talk to our salons in the Gulf Coast. And they were saying, you know, if you have a bunch of salons with hair, they could send it to us and have them, you know, send us all the nylons that they collect, too. When the women go into the salons, they drop off their runned nylons. And it just started this movement. And then pretty soon, all of the salons that were donating throughout the U.S. and Canada started to get local press. And then all of the other salons in that area signed up. And now we're just having so many sign-ups an hour that we can barely keep up. It's a huge movement, and we're very excited because we think it's actually creating an international natural fiber recycling phenomenon in a way. We had 600 interviews before 9 a.m. yesterday, requests from all over the country and Canada, even Spain. We were told that we've been on RTL in France all morning long, and now you. And once we were on BBC World, I think we can say that we're getting our 15 minutes of fame.
Well, I'm actually, but what you don't want is fame. You want lots of hair and lots of tights, and we're hoping to put a picture up of these booms on our website just to show what they are. These long, well, I don't really want to go that many details. They look like black cylinders. Amanda, why did you get excited about this? Lisa is clearly passionate about it.
Well, I live on Mobile Bay in Alabama, and I found out about Lisa when I went online and just tried to research a way that we could right here in my yard clean up after the spill, and what my neighbors and I could do if the spill came ashore. And I found Lisa, and I posted my findings on Facebook, and just within a matter of days, there were thousands and thousands of people inquiring and asking me how we could get it. And so that's how it began for me. And now we have hundreds of volunteers waiting for hair to begin building these booms. We're having boom-bee-cues, and it's the whole community is behind the project.
A boom-bee-cues. I understand you call them Alabama sausages.
We're calling them Alabama sausages.
So what is it now? Are you going to gather people, what, in a public area, hundreds of volunteers to start stuffing those tights with hair?
Well, the original concept was we would just start these in my the friends, and now it's gotten so big we have set up staging areas at different restaurants and locations around town where we hope to just make hair available all day, and you come by and you stuff as long as you want. And it's really a family event. Kids are doing it. Grandparents are doing it. You know, everybody in the family. And everybody in the neighborhood is shaving their dog as well.
So what, have your children and dog shaved their hair for this project?
They're all bald.
Oh, no. Are you bald, too?
No. I haven't gone that far yet, but they're eyeballing my hair, I can tell you.
Your children are now bald?
Oh, no. They have had quite a cut, and my dogs are very large dogs, and they're shaved very, they've got nice summer dews now.
And I understand you've got hair arriving from very far away as well.
Oh, had a package come from Hong Kong, and had a girl in the Philippines call this morning and say she was cutting off 16 inches of her hair and wanted to send it to us. So the response has just been amazing. You know, we live in a hurricane zone, and we're used to being ready to prepare for hurricanes. You know what to do. You get water, you board up your house, there are things to do, but no one knows what to do when an oil spill is coming ashore. So the only thing we know is to try to make these booms and save our shores.
Lisa, you've got a real army out there with people like Amanda and her family, even the dogs are getting involved. But really, is it a big enough army to take on this oil spill?
Well, that's the interesting thing. We have so much hair. If this can be coordinated in a way that works for for the trucking to come in from the alpaca farmers and the sheep farmers, and we have groups like Petco that have thousands of groomers through all of their stores. There's large chains that have many stores that are coordinating with all of their salons. Yes, I think that we could make a substantial dent. We spoke with British Petroleum today, and we're going to speak with them again later. They have the information about the specs of the hair and the nylons. And what we keep saying is there needs to be a stronger mesh over the nylons. As women all know, nylons run. It'll hold the hair in place, but then there has to be a stronger mesh over it if it's going to be used along beaches or dragged at all. And we have all of that information on our website, and we also are hoping that British Petroleum might like to pay for that mesh, because it's very expensive, especially since we've grown exponentially in the last 8 days. And between Friday the 30th and the following Tuesday, we grew more than we had in the previous 12 years. And since then, we've just been doubling and tripling, and it's just huge. So the mesh costs for this will be very high.
Lisa Gauthier, ending that interview with the BBC. For more on the hair and hosiery project, go to the show notes. That's at theworld.org/technology. We'll put some links there for you.
I hate that thing!
You gotta love the Jetsons. Now, let's take a rare look inside one of Britain's most secretive institutions, GCHQ. GCHQ is Britain's equivalent, more or less, of the U.S.'s National Security Agency. And as such, reporters are rarely allowed to access GCHQ. But the BBC's Gordon Carrera managed it and sent in this report that's got all sorts of little tech goodies in it. Here we go.
Cheltenham on a Monday morning, at one of Britain's most secret establishments.
Hello, we're from the BBC.
Good morning, yes.
Good morning.
Names?
Gordon Carrera and Mark Savage.
Ah, great. I'll open the gate, just follow the fence path round, you come to another turnstile, there's a man in, tick your name off his list again and let you through.
Great, thank you very much.
Have a nice day.
Signs are everywhere, warning us that we're entering a prohibited place under the Official Secrets Act.
Good morning. From the BBC?
Yeah.
My name's Gordon Carrera.
Razor wire is wrapped around the steel building.
You know where you're going?
Straight up.
Straight up, automatic door, reception desk in front of you.
Gaining entry requires passing through layer after layer of ever-tightening security. Not many outsiders have been in this place, but we're being given exclusive access to the Government Communications Headquarters, or GCHQ, the least talked about branch of British intelligence.
Your identification,
sure.
Please.
Driver's licence or something?
Yes,
or
thank right? You.
GCHQ's mission is to intercept communications, to collect what's known as signals intelligence. It does this by intercepting phone calls, faxes and emails in the interests of national security. It's an effort which spans the globe. They're used to listening into conversations, but today, at a morning video conference, we're turning the microphones on them.
Good morning, everyone. If we just do the normal comms check, please, starting in London, MOD.
Good morning, Brian. See and hear you fine, thanks.
OK, PGHQ.
Staff working in support of military operations call in one by one.
Kabul.
Appearing on a giant plasma screen.
Good morning, Sheldon. Can you hear and see you fine?
Kandahar.
Good morning. See and hear you fine.
Helmand.
Morning, all. See and hear you fine.
JDSC.
See and hear you fine, thank you.
OK, and do we have Site 12 out there?
Even GCHQ suffers from the occasional communications breakdown.
OK, we've got a bit of a conflict with Site 12, but we'll carry on and hopefully she'll kick in later. OK, thank you all very much. We'll start now. If I could just ask our colleagues from the BBC to leave, I'd be very grateful. As we move into a classified section, thank you very much indeed. Don't leave any boxes there with red flashing lights.
We've been allowed in, but we certainly can't access all areas and are never without an escort. There are signs throughout the building warning that the BBC will be recording over the next 2 days.
Swipe and print here, yeah.
Our tour guide is Sarah. Most of the staff prefer to use only their first name. She's private secretary to the director of GCHQ.
So this is the main foyer as you come into the building.
The place is nicknamed the Donut. The building forms a round circle with a hole in the middle. The architecture is reminiscent of a modern airport. Staff sit in front of computer screens in open-plan offices. Normally, GCHQ is a hermetically sealed bubble of security. We're intruders and our presence is soon noticed.
We also have a voice PA system, as you can
what
hear
What was that
there.
For?
I'm not sure, really. I didn't quite catch what they said. But
something about lowering the blinds.
It turns out members of staff are worried about what we might see on their computer screens and have called for the internal window blinds to be lowered. GCHQ has always been perhaps the least glamorous but the most secretive of Britain's intelligence agencies. Not everyone is happy about us being here. Secrecy is part of the culture. Sarah's boss is the head of GCHQ, Ian Lobban.
Yes, there's probably a useful mystique which attaches to GCHQ. I heard on a different news channel the other day somebody referring to both the UK's intelligence agencies, so I thought I worked out that's probably MI5 and MI6 and not GCHQ. So sometimes people forget about us, and yes, sometimes that can actually be quite helpful. Against that, I believe in accountability, I believe in openness, and I think we should be accessible where we can be. There are red lines. I don't want to tell you precisely what I can or cannot do in terms of exploiting communications because I would see my adversaries or intelligence targets or terrorists move to different communications behaviour.
Mathematicians are still vital to its work on codes. Encryption is now widely used. That makes communications more secure for governments and private individuals, but also for terrorists and those foreign governments GCHQ is trying to target. Modern codes are fiendishly complex, and it's Joanna's job to crack them.
Most codes nowadays are made with computers, so it's not like the olden days where a code might have been a string of letters, which is your message, and you replace each letter with a different letter. Nowadays, because everything's done on computers, you change your message to a string of basically ones and zeros, and that's called the plain text, and you have what's called a keystream, which is a random series of ones and zeros that you add to that, and that's called your cipher. Breaking codes is all about trying to work out how that keystream was generated. Once you've got the keystream, you can take it from the cipher, and then that's your message. So it's as simple as that.
It doesn't sound like it's going to be that simple to actually do it, though.
No, there's all sorts of clever techniques that you have to do.
And is there a sense of satisfaction when you crack one?
Very much so.
What's it feel like?
Oh, it just feels amazing, really. I mean, you feel like you've won. I mean, really, you're doing it for a reason, because somebody said this is something they want to get into. So then you ring them up and you say, I've got it. And then they're absolutely astounded, because to them it's magic. So.
We're heading with Chris as our guide into the inner sanctum of GCHQ.
And a few flights of stairs coming down.
Lying deep beneath GCHQ's steel donut, underneath the hole in the middle, is its electronic brain. Thousands of racks of computers can be found humming 24 hours a day, accompanied by an elaborate cooling system.
Now, this is just one of four computer halls we have here. We have a total of about 10,000 square metres of computer hall space. I could actually fit Wembley football pitch into three of the halls quite comfortably. It's generally accepted that within this environment, we've got a couple of the most powerful computers within the sort of Western Europe area.
I guess you've got to be pretty careful that nothing does break down here.
One of the big issues that we have in here is obviously the reliance that GCHQ has on its IT. We do ensure that the IT itself is as protected as much as possible, but that comes at a cost.
The advanced computer technology that now drives GCHQ's work once threatened its survival. During the 1990s, GCHQ not only lost its traditional enemy, the Soviet Union, but also found itself facing a digital revolution with the advent of the Internet. Not everyone was sure it would be able to rise to the challenge, but GCHQ adapted and had to keep on adapting. Gavin is a deputy director responsible for that.
It's no understatement at all to talk about the Internet as the biggest, most fundamental technology change to affect GCHQ. I guess on two or three levels. First is the sheer scale of it, something like 2 billion users of the Internet now, and that's still growing. But also the diversity of it. It's not just about phone calls and it's not just about faxes. There are so many ways that our targets can communicate on the Internet. And so us having to respond to that variety of means of communications is also a big challenge. But I think the third thing that's important to GCHQ about the Internet is the pace of change.
Because we're not just talking about emails, we're talking about applications, talking about all kinds of ways in which people communicate now.
Yeah, there's just such a huge number of ways of communicating on the Internet. The whole Web 2.0 thing, social networking, voice over IP. There are easily 500 major applications out there for the likes of you and me to use as we're communicating on the Internet. And that's a massive challenge to GCHQ because it's a lot more complicated than traditional communication systems.
And you find that the targets you're working against are very adaptive to new technology?
Yes, absolutely. Some of our targets are particularly agile, security aware. They clearly expect that surveillance and interception is going to happen, and we have to stay one step ahead of them.
As well as intercepting online communications, GCHQ advises the government on how to protect itself from the growing tide of cyber attacks, whether from other states or from criminals. Dave works on what's known as the Information Assurance Team.
The time you see it sometimes is about the time that the attacker is actually using it. Therefore, we've got to get information to government as fast as we can and as accurately as we can. No good panicking them. We have to give them the right information in the right way to defend themselves.
What are most people trying to do to government then? Are people trying to steal information effectively from government? Is that what it is?
One is very much the information. Foreign states and lots of other entities would like information. There's also the organised crime aspect. Now, some organised crime would like information, but also what they'd like to do is get a financial gain out of their attacks. However, at the same time, you've got to be fair to say that in organised crime, certain information would benefit them as well. If they could get into the police networks, for example, people that testify against them in court, informants, what operations the police are mounting against various people, that kind of information would be very useful to them.
It sounds like a real battle, day to day. It sounds like your day to day, you're in the trenches.
We cannot rest. There is potential for every single day there to be a new posting somewhere on the internet about a new weakness.
Good morning, Charlton. Can you hear on the TV fine?
Back at the morning video conference, staff are in touch with colleagues deployed to work alongside the military, including in Afghanistan.
Morning, all. See you fine.
Out in Afghanistan, it may be clear who the enemy is. But in the vast swamp of global communications, and with all the supercomputers whirring away in the basement, how can we be sure that GCHQ isn't listening to us? Director Ian Lobben.
Can we listen to everything? No, we can't. Do we try to listen to everything? No, we don't. There's a vast amount of communication out there. Our approach is to be as surgical as possible.
There have been reports that you're building some super huge database down in the basement here to collect all the communications data, and that you'll have access to everyone's phone records, email records. Is that true?
No, it is not true.
No such database, no such access.
There's no such database, there's no such access, and it would be impossible anyway in my view. So,
what do you hear? There's lots of speculation about things called Echelon and some systems for being able to listen to all kinds of private communications around the world.
Yes, I read about some of these in books. I particularly like the one which says anytime anybody says the word bomb in a conversation, that tapes start whirring and an individual is geolocated. It's simply not like that.
An American Secretary of State remarked in the 30s that gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail. But governments have always wanted to do just that, and more. In the 2 days we've spent inside GCHQ, we've glimpsed more than most outsiders would ever normally see of how communications are intercepted in the modern world. But I also know there's a lot more we weren't allowed to see. What that might be will inevitably remain the subject of speculation, buried beneath even deeper layers of secrecy.
The BBC's Gordon Carrera there. Now, that's a cut-down version of a 30-minute documentary called Cracking the Code. I'll put the link to that full program up at theworld.org/technology.
Oh, George, you pushed the wrong button again.
All right, this week we're going to end with a podcast-exclusive interview. Now, if you follow the World's Technology Podcast, you know we do a lot on technologies being created for or in the developing world. This week, we feature a woman who has turned the idea on its head a little bit, Carolina Vallejo, originally from Colombia. She's from Bogota, the Colombian capital. She was born and raised there, and she ended up at NYU to do a master's degree in art, design, and technology. She's come up with a competition called Design for the First World, or DX1W. Here's the tagline, the rest saving the West, from the website designforthefirstworld.com. I'm reading that this is, quote, a competition for designers, artists, scientists, makers, and thinkers in developing countries to provide solutions for first world problems. So I wanted to get Carolina on Skype to ask her how this came about. And it all started, she was in a class, and they asked the class to do a design for something around social change. But Carolina didn't feel that they gave them any context, and they only gave them a week to complete the assignment. So
I was furious. Being Colombian, I've been subject to aid in social change, design, and good intentions. So I was really furious and decided to design something for this kind of social change that I wanted to see happening. So I just inverted the equation a little bit as a sarcastic comment in the beginning. And that's how this idea came about.
So you get this assignment for this class, and it you flip it on its head, and you sort of the idea here is to invite people from the developing world, the third world, to solve the problems or some of the problems or try to solve the problems of the first world. Did you have specific problems in mind in the first world that you would like people to try to solve?
Yes, I have four problems that I'm asking people to solve after several weeks of research and discussion with my friends and professors here. There are low birth rate and aging population, which to me was really obvious, but surprisingly it hasn't been as obvious for the rest of the people. There's a clear problem on the imbalance between births and deaths in the first world, especially in countries like Japan or some European countries, because it's breaking the social security system. And apart from that, the low birth rate is scary. People are, as they are more developed and more well off, they postpone and postpone and postpone having children. And that has bring a lot of health risks into women's. The amount of deaths at birth has raised in Europe.
Okay, so that's one problem. What were the others?
The other three is, one is obesity, the other one is consumerism, and the fourth one is the integration of immigration.
So how are you spreading the word then about the 'cause it is a competition, right?
It is a competition, right?
Yeah. Right. So how are you spreading the word about it? How are people finding out about it?
Social media is basically my best friend right now. I started a Twitter account and I tweet a lot. I have 200 followers. Facebook has been great. I have 800 followers from all over the world. And then it's just like emailing people. I do research in universities that do design and spread the word through there. Try to ask as many people as possible. This is like the only thing I have in my head for the last 3 months. I've just been thinking of this. So every person I meet, I just talk about this and ask them to spread them through their social networks.
Have you been surprised at the interest in it? I mean, it seems like it's struck a little bit of a chord.
Yeah, it was really surprising. I was kind of afraid the day that I launched it, because I didn't know how the first world was going to take it, and if they were going to be like hyper offended, and I was going to have like all these sensitive people that are just quote unquote trying to help coming and. But on the contrary, everyone is, I think it's a problem that everyone was seeing, but no one was saying. So the fact that I just had the courage to voice this was very well received.
One of the things, I mean, having covered topics like this for the last 5-6 years, I'm consistently amazed at the ideas that come out of the developing world. And especially as sort of uses of technology and things like that, it's really incredible to see the creativity and the way that things are used differently and the way that things are used, you know, for very definite purposes. And it seems to me that you're tapping into a little bit of that as well, that creativity.
Yeah, of course. I'm also trying to, well, one of the things here is that this competition has evolved. So at the beginning was just a sarcastic comment towards the first world and like a really visceral reaction. But as time has passed and I've worked more and more on this competition has changed focus a little bit. So the point of making the critique is there and it's being made, but I'm more interested in what's next and the action. So that's why I'm like really focusing on the people from the developing world, and I want us to wake up in a sense and dust off all this dependency and lose the comfort that we have, because it's very comfortable to have someone else to blame for all your problems and take responsibility and realize that we have a lot of talent and that we know how to do things and that we can control our countries and take agency. So that's basically it as well.
Well, Carolina, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Claire.
Carolina Vallejo there, creator of the Design for the First World competition. Now, that competition is open until the end of May. That's when the ideas will be presented to an international jury of thinkers, artists, and designers. The best project will get $1,000. It will also be featured in a catalog, and the work will be shown at a gallery in New York City. There'll be 15 or so other designs that will be exhibited and showcased in the catalog as well. So again, for more information on that, visit theworld.org/technology. I'll have links up to the Design for the First World competition. Now, why have I been playing Jetsons clips the whole podcast? Well, it's a good question. And it's because listener David J. Zachmeyer wrote in via email to comment on the story in podcast 286 about adding sounds so that people could better hear electric cars, the idea being that it may be a little bit dangerous for electric cars to be so quiet if you're a pedestrian or, trying to figure out where they are in traffic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. David wrote in, I'm surprised no one in your story mentioned the obvious choice for the electric car sound, the sound that George Jetson's car makes. Well, David writes, that's what I would choose anyway. He goes on, I suspect that when the market for electric cars really takes off, they will have user-configurable sounds and will buy and install them the same way we do with ringtones for our phones. Well, that got me thinking, what would your electric car ringtone be? Well, stop by the show notes and leave a comment. You just head over to theworld.org/technology. That's the clearinghouse for links, pictures, and videos that go along with the podcast. You can tell me what your favorite electric car ringtone would be there. You could also stop by the World's Technology Podcast page on Facebook. That's facebook.com/worldstechpod. We are closing in on 1,000 likers there on Facebook, by the way. That's our goal by the end of May, to have 1,000. So keep them coming, folks. Stop by over there. Usually a lot of good little tidbits and discussion going on there. And of course, you can always reach me via email, Clark, C-L-A-R-K, .Boyd, B-O-Y-D, at bbc.co.uk. Okay, in Brussels, this is me saying,
back to work, back to work, everybody. Work, 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 work.
Support for the World's Technology Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.